Most of us are pretty clear on some of the ebbs and flows of the climate of the planet Earth over the ages. There were warm periods, there were ice ages, and a lot of parts in between. But some of the assumptions even scientists made about the progressions are challenged by more recent findings, like the ones you're about to hear about from Russia. Scientists from the United States and Russia say findings in a cave in the Ural Mountains show temperature trends, warming, counter to the prevailing view of post-ice age temperature trends that have been held by scientists thus far. Two guests join us, Jonathan Baker, who's a PhD student in the geosciences at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the lead author of the recent publication in the journal Nature Geoscience on May 22nd. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. It's good to be here.
And Matthew Lochneid is with us as well. He's one of the professors, a geoscientist at UNLV as well. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
So, Jonathan, start us with the hypothesis. What is it you're looking for here in the Urals?
Our main goal, honestly, was just to fill in a data gap. We've got records from around the world that are used to reconstruct climate histories. And there aren't many good records from this part of the world. There's a huge swath of Russia where we've got a few scattered records that were at low resolution, low quality, not very well constrained in the age. And so we just wanted to fill in that data gap.
So when you talk about records, we're not talking about written records, are we? We're talking about things that are that marks upon the landscape or something?
Yes, these are geologic records. There are many ways to go about reconstructing the climate. You can look at biological proxies, as we call them, for example, pollen records that accumulated in a lake, and you could look at how vegetation changes. You could examine ice cores. You could examine lake sediments and tree rings and things like that.
So, Matthew Lochneid, it would seem like as big a landmass as Eurasia is, it would really help to have some findings from this part of the world.
Yeah, that's right, and that's the data gap that John Baker was able to solve, going into a place where somebody hadn't really done too much work in the past. And in fact, that's one of the things that we do as scientists, is we try to find unique opportunities to go to places that have been understudied and fill in the puzzle for Earth's climates by studying lots of different regions.
Have we learned a lot by filling in the record gap over the years, Matthew? I mean, is there a lot of stuff that's been filled in just in the last 20 or 30 years by this process?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen a proliferation of really high-quality science in the last two or three decades that fills in gaps in areas that had very little data before. And one of the ways that we do this is working with cave deposits. And the advantage of cave deposits is that they often extend for very long time periods. And we can figure out when they formed, date those records, for example, with a lot of precision for very long time periods, going back in some cases 600,000 years or potentially even longer. And you compare that to other records like tree rings, they might only go back 500 years. Or lake sediments might only go back, 20,000 or at most, 40,000 years, and you can't date them with radiocarbon past 35 or 40,000 years either. But we can go a lot further back in the cave records, and that's what John did for some of his PhD dissertation research.
I was going to ask you about ice cores, but those wouldn't even come close to 600,000 years either, would they?
The ones in Antarctica go back about 800,000 years.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
They do.
Okay. They do. Yep. Okay. So John Baker, then how did you decide? I mean, and who helped you? It looks like you had help on the Russian side. Olga Chervyatsova was one of the scientists named as one of the authors of this study. How did you decide where to take cave deposits from?
Great question. It was kind of a long search. Spent months just researching what caves were out there. Looking. Honestly, starting by looking online at caving groups and tourist pages and things like that, a few geological publications in Russian that listed various caves. And we were looking for a cave that had deposits, secondary formations like stalagmites and stalactites in it. There are many caves in Russia that have no such deposits that wouldn't do us any good. Needed a cave that had a stable climate, etc. We got lucky. My wife is from a city not too far from the cave site that we found, and she had a friend of a friend who was an amateur caver. And he put us in contact with Olga, and we told her what we were looking for, and she knew exactly where to find it. So we went out one summer and spent the field season there exploring this cave. And like I said, we were hoping to fill a data gap, find a Holocene record that's the last 12,000 years or so. in the middle of Russia, and that's exactly what we found.
When we say Holocene, we do mean the current period?
Yes, the Holocene describes the current warm period. It began about 11,700 years ago. It continues to the modern day.
Jonathan Baker and Matthew Lochneid are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. John's a PhD student in geosciences at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Matthew Lochneid is one of the professors at UNLV. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about what they found in a cave in Russia that clears up some gaps in knowledge about what has been happening with climate over the last bunch of years, and by that I mean bunches of thousands. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm kind of fascinated by, John, by you talking about caves having no deposits. I thought most caves had at least some sorts of drippy kinds of formations.
Most caves will, they'll have water running through them. They'll have some thin film deposits. What we're looking for are the stalagmites, and that's just because of the way they grow. They grow from drips on the ceiling that fall to the floor, and as these drips thin out into a small layer, the carbon dioxide in the water leaves, and that changes the pH of the water, and it causes it to precipitate a thin layer of calcite mineral. And so it does this repeatedly in the same spot. It forms nice concentric layers. So you know which layers are the oldest, which are the youngest, and that they go in order of age. We can also date those layers, as Matt noted, very, very precisely.
So, Matt, are we talking about the world's longest-lasting thermometer here? And what specifically in that stalagmite is going to tell you what the temperatures were back when?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the answer depends on your location. In this part of the world, in the Urals, I mean, it is very sensitive to temperature. Specifically, what we're looking at are variations in the oxygen that's contained within the limestone rock that forms that stalagmite. So we're looking at naturally occurring variations in the stable isotopes of oxygen. So there's a heavy oxygen, and then there's a lighter oxygen. And the relative amounts of those two change as a function of temperature. So, for example, when we see very low values, that corresponds to lower temperatures. When we see higher values, that corresponds to warmer temperatures. So what we do in the lab is we take a very precise drill at about every millimeter or half millimeter. We drill down the axis of the stalagmite, which has grown over time. And for each one of those little drill spots, we do a stable isotopic measurement in the lab. And then we're able to assign an age to each one of those measurements as well, too, by dating the stalagmite's layers as they grew up through time.
So clearly you had to remove the stalagmites from the cave. How many did you take, John Baker?
We took 5 in total. For this particular study, we analyzed 2. And they overlapped, which was great. The one of them had a couple gaps in the record. It stopped growing for a couple hundred years, and that's when the other one did not stop growing. And so we've got a record that's duplicated, actually, in the cave and shows that they're recording the same signal. That gives us a little bit more confidence in our reconstruction.
Were there any obstacles in terms of trying to carry off parts of the cave? I know that that behavior can get you in trouble in the United States, depending on which cave you do it in.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting question. Here, there were no municipal or federal regulations for this cave that would prevent us from taking samples. The downside is that it means people can come in and vandalize. Fortunately, this room was far removed from the entrance. It's very difficult to get to, and so nobody had hardly been in there, nobody that would want to steal the samples. So we were working with the cave team, whose job it is working with the local authorities to try and protect the cave, keep it clean, keep tourists from coming in and making a mess of the place. And so they granted us the permission because they were the ones in charge of overseeing the cave site.
So were they close together? I'm curious to know about how big a difference it might make from where in a cave system you draw your samples.
It does make a difference because caves ventilate. You know, they breathe, in a sense. During the winter months when the air temperature outside is colder than the cave, that's when it's more dense and it starts to flow in through the cave. And then in summer, it exhales that air. And so caves breathe. But because they breathe, that means the humidity in the cave can change, the temperature in the cave can change from one day to the next, 1 month to the next. We wanted to find a part of the cave that had a very stable climate that's integral to interpreting the isotope signal. As Matt mentioned, we look at the relative ratio of heavy to light oxygen. Well, if your cave temperature is changing, if the room temperature is changing constantly, then that will throw off the isotope signal, because you're not just recording the annual climate signal, but you're recording the local geometry of the cave and little ventilation signals, so to speak.
And Matthew Lochne, you described the process then, and then figuring out what the temperatures were like over the course of many thousands of years based on what you're finding by drilling into the stalagmites. What had you expected to find, and how did the data you got line up with those expectations?
Well, I've been doing science long enough to try to not to go in with any particular expectations, because nature tends to surprise us pretty frequently, which is what keeps the job interesting, of course. But the kind of the general idea of the evolution of climate over the last 11,000 years is we had a warming coming out of the last ice age as all the ice on the northern hemisphere melted away. And that warming peaked around 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, and then changes in the Earth's orbit have resulted in the northern hemisphere at least getting colder for the last 6,000 or 8,000 years. And that's kind of what we're testing our data against in this new paper, and we found something very different. First of all, the record that John collected is sensitive to winter temperatures. And we know that from various lines of data and reasoning. And what we saw was a temperature evolution that was very different. It basically showed cold conditions at the end of the last ice age, as one would expect, but very continual temperature rise towards the modern. And that conflicted with this idea that the peak warming was 6,000 or 8,000 years ago. And what we suggested in the paper is that concept of peak warming about 6,000 or 8,000 years ago was probably, at least in this part of the world or in the Ural region, was probably a summer temperature signal, whereas our record is a winter temperature signal. And that finding reinforces the idea that we need to find different records of climate that are registering different seasons as well, in order to get a comprehensive understanding of how climate has changed in a particular location.
So is the field often narrowed like that, that people say, well, look, just look at these summer temperatures? They tell you the whole story, but they're ignoring three other seasons of the year?
Well, I would say that it's more an issue of what records are available at a particular time. It takes a lot of human resources and finance to generate these types of records. So scientists are working with the records that they have. So I don't think anybody was particularly ignoring any other record. It's just as new records come in that help constrain a different aspect to the climate system, we have to fold them into our analyses.
So Jonathan Baker, as the lead author, give us a sense of what this means for the folks who may not go running straight to Nature Geoscience on May 22nd to read this, and what we might extrapolate from this more broadly, just as people concerned about what's going on with climate on the planet Earth.
Sure. So, the main thing we found, as Matt pointed out, is that we see continual warming during the winter months over the last 11 to 12,000 years. We found that was largely controlled by two factors. In the first part of the Holocene, that's up until about 7,000 years ago, it was the retreat of the ice sheets that caused winters to get warmer and warmer. And that's something we expected. That was nothing new. It was good to confirm that factor. We found that after 7,000 years, one of the dominant controls was greenhouse gas forcing. There is a slight rise in carbon dioxide and methane from about 7,000 years ago until today. And it is debated just how much of that was human contribution from, you know, early farming in the Neolithic period and deforestation, things like that, and how much of it was actually a natural contribution. In any case, that slight rise in greenhouse gases contributed to a very slow and gradual warming in this part of the world during the winter months. And that tells us that that it's not just today in the last century that carbon dioxide and methane have controlled surface temperatures, but that for a large part of the Holocene, as long as humans have been making civilizations, it has been one of the dominant controls. So that tells us that this part of the world is very sensitive to small changes in greenhouse gases. And over the past century, we've seen an astonishingly fast, anomalous spike in these greenhouse gases, as you know.
In the pre-industrial period, based on your recordings from the stalagmites, I mean, is there an indication of the level of sensitivity, like a 20% rise or a 5% rise in the greenhouse gases would cause X amount of temperature difference?
Yes, over that time period, we have a very smooth signal that shows something like a 1 degree Celsius warming over the last 7,000 years, and that coincides with just a 20 ppm rise in carbon dioxide, ppm meaning parts per million. Mm-hmm. So we know today we've just recently surpassed 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, whereas in the pre-industrial period it was at 280 parts per million. So that rise from 260 to 280 coincided with about a 1 degree Celsius warming over this period. Carbon dioxide was one factor if we look at methane, and we look at a couple other natural factors as well contributing to this slight warming. It is a little bit difficult to constrain the exact amount as you put it. That's something that's left to our collaborators who would work with climate models specifically and the physical models that can help tease out those numbers. But we showed the relationship pretty clearly, I think.
All right, so a warming that certainly does seem to track with more carbon dioxide and more methane in the atmosphere. The publication is called the article is called Holocene Warming in Western Continental Eurasia, Driven by Glacial Retreat and Greenhouse Forcing. It's in Nature Geoscience, the May 22nd issue. You just heard Jonathan Baker, the lead author, Matthew Lochneat, listed number two. We also have Olga Tervyatsova, Yamani Osmaram, and Victor J. Polyak. And I want to thank John Baker and Matthew Lochneat from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas for joining us today to talk about some really interesting things going on in climate science. Are you going back, John Baker?
Absolutely. Be back soon enough.
Okay. We will look for the results of that down the road. Thanks again for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.